The Magic Book Club with Benson's for Beds.
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of the Magic Book Club podcast. I'm Emma B.
10 points. Well done, you are. I'm Tom Price.
Thank you.
Hello.
Oh, well done.
Yes.
We got that bit right.
It's 10 all. And today, that's the last thing I'll get factually correct throughout the podcast. Today we are taking a look back on the year of Magic Book Club podcasts.
I don't know about you, Tom. I've had the best. I mean, in terms of books, I've had a great year. It's been amazing. And in amongst all this crazy stuff that's been going on, pandemics, protests, elections, to have been able to read such incredible literature and fiction and non-fiction in amongst this time has been a huge saviour.
Helping us escape. I like the way you said the B word very quickly. So Brexit, very, very quickly. Just so we're technically not bringing it up. But I know what you mean. Throughout all the hard stuff that's been going on in the news and the real life, and these books have been such a comfort to keep us sane, I reckon.
Absolutely. So sit back then. Are you comfortable? Because for the next half an hour, we're going to take you through some of our best books of the year.
So cast your minds back to February, everyone. Can we do that?
What?
This is when we need a harp sound effect. Snow was on the ground, possibly somewhere. There were stirrings of something in the air. There was sort of like second or third article on the news. But, you know, it wasn't really going to change the world, was it? Well, let's not dwell on that. Anyway, talking of February, which I can barely remember, one thing that sticks in my memory was interviewing the brilliant Michael Cashman. Now, you probably know him best, and he's kind of fine with this, as Colin from EastEnders. You remember Colin from EastEnders, right? In the 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
Absolutely superb actor who went on to then have a career in politics, an incredible activist, a very, very, very inspiring man. And I got to meet him, which was wonderful. He had a book out, The Story of His Life. And this is a nice intro into the book club, throwing it way back to February with some showbiz action, where we find Michael Cashman talking about what life was like back then and mentioning one Elizabeth Taylor. Have a listen to this.
I had wonderful, wonderful parts, and, you know, working with Elizabeth Taylor, that wonderful film I did with her. And it was a very small cast of Michael Caine, Susanna York, John Standing, Elizabeth Taylor, Margaret Leighton. And I just had 1 week on the film, this very important scene with Elizabeth. And I said, I wanted a photograph taken with her. And everyone said, no, not possible. Absolutely not possible. Not with Elizabeth. And on the last day, I plucked up and I said, Miss Taylor, could I have Elizabeth, because she liked you to call it her Elizabeth, could I have a photograph taken with you? And she went, oh, sure. Well, let's do it on your last day. I said, well, today is my last day. And they just called a wrap, which, as you know, it's the day when the studio closes down that day, all the lights are off.
Very tightly regulated,
because otherwise it's money. Mm. And Elizabeth Taylor just turned around and went, let's have some lights around here. And somebody said, what? She said, I want the lights on. And so somebody went, put the lights on, put that. And then somebody else said, who's turning the lights on? It's Elizabeth. Elizabeth wants to get the lights on, get the lights on. We had our photographs taken. And then off she went. She pecked me on the cheek. Off she floated. And only Elizabeth Taylor could cost a studio thousands and thousands of dollars by having a photograph taken for me. And the photo's in the book, and it's a lovely photograph for no other reason that it proves that once upon a time I did have long curly hair.
There it was. Well, you both look beautiful in that photograph.
Oh, he's so ace.
Such a beautiful guy. And, you know, this guy was an actor with an incredible career behind him already, as told in that story, but then went on to become an MEP. He was the co-founder of Stonewall. He's a really important, significant guy.
Yeah. And I didn't know, and I think that's one of the really fun things about talking to people about biographies or, you know, their nonfiction work. You find out so much about them that you didn't know. And even though they live their life in the limelight or, you know, in public positions of public profile, you know, like Michael has done, there are still these absolute gems of stories that they tell so well. And because of his acting background, he delivers them brilliantly. And it must have been amazing to sit there and hear that for you.
Yes, it was. It was brilliant. And he'd stop a story and I didn't have any follow-up questions because, you know, let's let people know the truth about interviewing is that towards the end of a story, any interviewer starts to think, right, what's my next question? And several times he was telling a story and he'd get to the end and I'd go, Oh, sorry. I don't know what to say next. Michael Cashman, one of them, is a really great book, and I thoroughly enjoyed meeting him. What a top guy.
So one of the things that we do, don't we, when we speak to the authors that we get to speak to, is find out about what gets them to put pen to paper. And sometimes they talk at length about their quite unconventional methods behind book writing, because everybody has their own way. Everybody's got their own way of approaching writing, thinking about anything. But when you've got a great big plot to sort out, there were several very different approaches that we heard about over the year. And a few months ago, I got to catch up with the lovely Dolly Alderton and her new book, Ghosts. And Dolly, I mean, I was really honest about this, I think, before, is I just didn't expect to like this as I did expect to like, but not as much as I did. Mm. Ghosts refers to the art, the terrible affliction of ghosting. But it's also a bit more complicated like that. And it follows a young adult who, you know, is going through the trauma of dating in this hideous online world anyway. But her characters are amazing. It's very of its time, obviously. If you're a millennial, you will sympathise massively and have every understanding about what...
As a millennial, I get that. Sure, yeah.
Right, okay. Like, about 10 years past that, babes. Come on.
Yeah, you get Channel 4 plus 1. I'm millennial plus 10. That's what I am.
And she came in to talk, and of course she's got a journalist background, and she was an agony aunt as well. So she has this like vast, you know, history of people and their stories. And so she writes with great knowledge and great understanding and empathy. But the way that she, we'll have a listen to this, because this is about how she just approaches the hard job of plot writing.
So I'm a meticulous and bizarrely ordered planner in a way that I have never, ever seen in another writer. And I'm worried makes me actually not that creative. Like every time I try and explain the system to another writer, they're just like, that sounds mad. So with Ghosts, I did 3 months every day just planning.
Goodness. Wow.
Yeah, I'm so, like, I would not be able to write without a plan. I've always done that with my journalism as well. And I kind of divided the story into 5 plots. This is when I'm going to start to sound crazy. So it's, you know, they were color-coded plots.
Oh, and then my God.
It's mad. And basically, if the higher it was on the plot list, so if it's the A story, then that's the one that you would need most of. And then the lower kind of rung stories were the funnier stories or the stories that didn't have as much importance with propelling the plot forward, that were more like textural plots. I then, when I did these huge planning documents, would have every beat of the story would be in the colour. So when I looked and then I printed them all out, you would not believe the amount of money that I spent at the printing shop in Camden. When I printed them all out, I would be able to see from a bird's eye view, when I looked down, if there was too much. So let's say the D story is purple. If there's too much purple in part 2, then it means I've done something wrong, because there should only be a little light sprinkling of purple.
Goodness me.
I know, right?
That's
meticulous,
but also very mathematical, isn't it?
Well, and I think that's what, because I remember we had the great pleasure this year of speaking to Anthony Horowitz about the Moonflower murders, which was a follow-up to the Magpie murders, which is a murder within a murder. And this is going back to the murder before that and reflecting on, I mean, literally, it's so complicated, I can't even explain it, but to write it. But especially with some of these crime fiction authors or, you know, complicated friendship relationship books that, you know, that sort of span many, many years, your plot, it has to be everything. And Anthony Horowitz said to us that he had, you know, walls covered in the old school bits of string going from the church to the post office.
Wow.
You know, and he would sometimes get up and walk through in his head the corridors. You know, if he was saying, if something happened at the end of a corridor and it was to the left, that he would walk it through in his head to, you know, to be absolutely. And it is absolutely incredible to delve into the mind of these guys, and probably explains why when I just sit there with a piece of paper, go, oh, I'm going to write write a story today. It doesn't happen.
It's absolutely astonishing, isn't it? Did you ever read The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle by Stuart Turton? That was a similar sort of thing.
No, but I've heard about it. It's on the list.
It's on the list. Read that and that will blow your mind as well. But what's really interesting when we talk to all these authors is hearing how they're either meticulous planners like that or they're seat of panters. I mean, this is a thing. Regular listeners to the show will know the panters. And Lee Child is a good example, although he's handed the reins to his brother this year. But Lee Child sits down, writes a sentence. You know, the guy was stuck in the underground car park or whatever. He has no idea what's happening next.
Are you serious? I didn't know that. Wow. Wow. That's amazing.
Anyway, we must move on. It's been a year of reading and it's also been a year of baking.
We all started with such enthusiasm, didn't we? We started with such enthusiasm. What can I say? I mean, I don't know why we ever thought we were all going to run out of bread, but there you go. We did. We tried all sorts of things. I started growing my own vegetables. I was like, I'm going to grow my way out of this crisis. Kids, you're never going to starve. Don't worry. There'll always be a lettuce in the garden. I guess what was good about this is that we were all inward looking a little bit more. We went back to trying to discover old skills. And how could we forget when the nation's baking sweetheart Nadia won the Great British Bake Off all those years ago? And she did the same thing. And of course, she's been baking up a storm ever since. And she came in to talk about her new book, which took her back to her baking roots. And also, I think if you've ever tried any of Nadia's recipes, and I have several times, when you kind of just go, hang on a second, you want me to put the salted caramel in the baked potato?
I love that.
But it is true. And then she'll kind of, there's a cake on a cake on a cake, or there'll be a sausage roll in another. It's just one of those, she's like got this incredible imagination. Yeah. And it would appear that that's when she has all her best ideas. Where do these recipes start, Nadia? I mean, you seem to have, you're so sort of, there seem to be this sort of endless creative ideas coming from your big baking brain. Where do they start? Where do these recipes start?
Some of my most kind of outrageous ideas come to me in the middle of the night. So I will think something up, or I will eat something and think, oh, that'd be a bit nice if it was a little bit different. And I'm one of those people, I am those annoying people that go to restaurants and think, I eat it, and you can see me going, trying to taste what's in there. And so I'm trying to work stuff out. And my husband does, sometimes he has to tell me, he's like, okay, you can turn it off now. You don't have to be working. And I'm like, oh, but let me just quickly put a little note in my phone. And so I'm constantly, it's always, and it's a part of, I suppose, how I was made. And this is who I am. And it's just, I'm always trying to recreate different things. But some of my best ideas come to me in the middle of the night. And problem with getting those ideas in the middle of the night is that if I don't write them down, sometimes writing them down doesn't suffice. I have to get up and make it. So I push it for as long as I can. And I might wake up at, rather than 6, I might wake up at 5 and start slowly, like, measuring out ingredients and pottering around to try and get this thing in the oven. And my husband's just like, just stop, go back to bed. And I won't do it. Sometimes, some of my best ideas come to me in the middle of the night. Like chicken donuts, come on.
Oh my goodness me, of course. Well, I mean, you'd have to be in some kind of dream state to think of that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I often get asked if I write my recipes drunk, and I say, I don't even drink.
No,
I don't even drink.
Of course not.
I mean, imagine if I was drunk, imagine the recipes I'd then get, you know, imagine the recipes I'd create then. Like, these are non-drunk recipes.
Amazing.
That sounds like a recipe book, doesn't it? Non-drunk recipes. Yeah. But she's like, literally, she is as gorgeous as you totally expect her to be. What was really interesting about this book as well is that's how we came to introduce ourselves. We came to meet her through Bake Off. But did you know, baking really wasn't part of her family at all. She didn't, the kitchen was very busy,
right.
But it wasn't, baking wasn't part of her Indian culinary life.
So how did she get into it then?
And so, she just got into it, but this is where I think she's still so sort of inspired by it. She's been given all the skills through just, you know, being in the kitchen and ingredients and flavours. But this is, you always feel with Nadia that this is as exciting for her as it is for us. Do you know what I mean?
She's got that brilliant thing whenever she's on camera and she just looks right down the barrel, and you know she's got such a good connection with her audience, and you get that she's talking to you, and you think she's just sort of snuck up next to you and said, chicken donuts, let's do this. Like, there's just, you buy it.
I felt a lot like that when you looked straight down the camera with your bake-off challenge that we did during...
Listen.
You nailed it. What are you talking about? You nailed that. You didn't go off and just mess around. That was considered and professional and competitive.
It took me hours. Well, I am. I'm certainly one of those things that you just listed off. Competitive, definitely not considered, definitely not professional. As well, you know, Emma. But I really wanted to do something different because I found recently that I am... We're falling back into horrible gender stereotypes in our house. My wife is doing all the cooking and baking, and I'm not, and I don't like that. And I don't, because I love cooking, but it just seems to be happening that way. And I wanted the kids to see me baking and to see that dads get in the kitchen and do all sorts of stuff. And I had a tremendous amount of fun, but my goodness, the mess we made! It was just appalling. There was like just sugar and flour, and I made that stuff. What's the stuff in the middle of crunchies? What's the yellow stuff in the middle of crunchies called?
Honeycomb.
Yeah, I made honeycomb.
Yeah, you did.
It's like a chemistry experiment. Have you ever made it?
Yeah, it's brilliant fun. You put the you end up put, when you put the bicarbonate of soda in it, yeah. It just goes, you're like, whoa,
yeah.
We should do this every day.
I know, it's incredible. And also, brilliant, if you need to fill your teeth with sugar, get some honeycomb in your life. It's really worked wonders there. So obviously this year has been tough, and not just for my dentist. It's not all doom and gloom, though, because humans have continued to advance into space. I feel like there should be an echo there. Space, space, space.
Space.
Perhaps beyond. Do you remember?
Beyond.
Thank you. Do you remember the SpaceX launch in November? Absolutely amazing.
It was nuts, wasn't it? It was crazy because there was a huge big fuss about it. But I think it's been so long since something like that happened that you kind of go, what, really? Really?
Yeah.
And then we were watching it dock with millimetre precision.
Yeah.
Thousands and thousands of miles away from Earth.
Incredible.
You know,
a private rocket launched into space. Off it goes and syncing up with... the space station. And what was brilliant was that we could all watch it from Earth. You could see, and there was this fantastic stuff, especially with Twitter and everything. People would say to you, right, you need to look southwest at 9:43 p.m. or whatever, which for me and Beth meant staying up and looking into the night sky and seeing that star that was moving and thinking, that is a human thing that a man's private company has sent into space. And that is amazing. And that is what space is all about, that moment of inspiration, the power of what people can do. And I'm not going to forget talking to real-life space journalist Sarah Crudas in a hurry. We talked about all sorts. I posed all my questions that I've had about space since I was about 6 years old to her. And also, she provided some excellent Mars gossip.
Do you know, I think the thing with Mars is it almost feels like science fiction. So I was born in the 80s, so I'm a child of the 90s. And I remember thinking, well, I was told that 2020 was the year that humans were going to walk on Mars. And I remember thinking, wow, 2020 is a long way away. but it was. So I always grew up believing 2020. And a lot of, like, space is cool now. It wasn't cool to be in the 90s to like space or the early noughties, but it's cool. It's got a bit of a resurgence now, which I love. But 2020 was the year we were meant to go to Mars. And actually, if you go further back during Apollo, if we'd have carried on with the same momentum of Apollo, and I talk about this in the book, Wernher von Braun, who, of course, built the rocket, the Saturn V, which took humans to the moon. He was convinced we had the technology to get humans to Mars by the 1980s. And if we'd carried on with the same rate, it's laughable now, but think how laughable landing on the moon is. If we'd have carried on at the same rate as Apollo, we would have seen humans on Mars, by the 1980s.
Imagine where we would be by now.
Exactly. Oh, and now we think we would have been by 2020, but instead we got the space age we live in today, and space became about using space to benefit life on Earth. So actually, you know, we talk about Mars, and it's kind of difficult to put the number on. I like to say that our Mars walkers walk among us. The first human being to walk on Mars is most likely alive right now. They're most likely a child, so they're probably in either primary school or early secondary school. So if anyone listening to this a child, they could be the first human being to walk on Mars. And I think what space teaches us is that nothing's impossible, and it doesn't matter who you are or where you come from, you can achieve those dreams. So within the next 20 to 30 years, we will see humans on Mars, which I know sounds like science fiction. We've got to return to the moon first, but change is happening much faster than you realize.
Oh, it's good, isn't it?
I don't know what to say. I'm so excited. Did you go home immediately after that interview and start measuring thunder and lightning up for spacesuits?
I was talking to the kids within seconds. The kids were downstairs. Because I recorded from home, I nearly shouted them, come up here, boys! Come all the way up here and then keep going till you get to Mars. Thank you. It is that sort of inspiration.
She's amazing.
Yes.
She's amazing. amazing. She knows everything.
You need that enthusiasm, and you need to, you know, you need to overcome that defeatism and think about what science can get us. And now, in fact, when we were recording that, we were in the midst of the pandemic, and here we are now with vaccines everywhere, and you see the power of science and research and facts, and talking to her mixed in that childish glee, that joyful enthusiasm about science with what it can do for us. And it was an intoxicating combination. I loved chatting to Sarah. Absolutely brilliant.
So as we get to the end of the year, we all start making resolutions, yours being, I'm going to go to Mars.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to try. I've made a crunchy, so now I'm going to go to Mars. Done.
Well, brilliant. I mean, you know, you've got to start somewhere. That's progress. Making promises to themselves. You know, lots of people talking a big game. I think I'm definitely, I've been just toying with the idea of trying to run. Like, but you know what I mean?
Good.
And I'm going to get through. I'm going to read more. I'm going to do more crosswords. I'm going to, you know, increase my vocabulary. I'm going to be not so grumpy, all that kind of thing. But you didn't wait until the new year to start making out. Like, frankly,
I know what this is.
I can't believe you said this out loud. You said it out loud, didn't you? You made quite an outrageous claim, because this is not easy.
Can I just say, this was after we'd recorded the pod, but the sneaky producer, Alex, kept recording and captured this moment. And I... Come on then, let's listen to it.
I think we should.
You catch me on page 1100 out of 1400 of War and Peace. Even though I haven't quite got to the end, I can already say it's the best book I've ever read.
People I know who've read it, and it's my Everest, it's sitting there, I need to crack on with it. Because one day I'm going to die and I need to read War and Peace. And the problem I've got is that apparently it's impossible to remember who is who. Have you got a system?
The version I have has a really simple character list at the end, and there are essentially only 8 or 10 characters that you meet constantly. Uh-huh. So, you know, if it's a Russian general, I kind of vaguely note his name, but as a personality, I know he's not going to be somebody that I'm going to get involved with his emotional life, for example. Right. Whereas Pierre and Andre and Natasha and Sonia and Hélène, you know, don't let that put you off. And I put the page with the character list, I just put a little kind of postcard in there. So I'm at the beginning, I referred to it quite regularly. Who's that? Mm. Who's related to it? But it sort of boils down as you read it to actually very few people in the book that you desperately care about. And I so recommend it. I've been dreading it. And then I picked it up, and I first page in, I couldn't put it down.
There you go. So I should have said, sorry, that's Victoria Hislop, who this year released One August Night. Fantastic book, brilliant writer.
I think we cut it off a little bit early there, though, didn't we? Because what was the result of that conversation? I think we did. I think we did, because you have decided you're going to read it on. You're going to give it a go.
I said I'm going to read it. She recommended the best translation. It's all about the translation for these books, because the one that was doing the rounds was from about 1950, which was really old-fashioned English, very stilted, very literal translation, hard to read, not much fun to read. And when you're reading War and Peace, which is the size of, you know, a small saloon, you need it to be written in accessible English. So there is a translation by Anthony Briggs, and so this is the translation she recommended, the Anthony Briggs translation of War and Peace. I downloaded it on my Kindle. I've got an update for you, Emma, and I was doing this weekly on my weekend breakfast show. I was keeping the listeners
well
to date on how I was getting on. I've had a pause. I've taken a pause. Right, I'm enjoying it, but I've taken a pause.
Yep. Is it just a pause? Are you sure?
No. I'm going to go back to it. I'm on 23%.
Okay. Right. So that's what are you? You're a fifth of the way through.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So I've,
that's
I've read,
amazing.
You know, effectively,
well
I've
done.
Read about 16,000 pages. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And is it? Let's stick with the percentage. It's more believable. And are you finding it? Is it a companion?
Yeah, it's good.
Is it absolutely?
Yeah.
You can't put it down.
I last read Tolstoy at university. I read Anna Karenina, and I loved that. But that was 20 years ago. So I haven't read any Tolstoy for that long, and I really am enjoying it. It's beautifully written. It's incredible to think how modern it feels. And that's partly translation, but also partly Tolstoy being light years ahead of his time, writing deep, emotional, proper character depth and stuff happening and wonderful. I mean, the action sequences are brilliant.
you're going to be impossible after you've read it. You are going to be impossible after you've read it.
I mean, I'm pretty tricky now, to be honest.
We're going to have to buy you a badge or something. Just go, well done, Tom. Well done. Yes. Well done. Yes,
I'm going
well
to want
done.
A badge in 2021. I want a badge that says I've been vaccinated, and I want a badge that says I've read War and Peace. Thank you.
There you go. Now, talking War and Peace, I know we touched on this during our last podcast, but it was... This is a very big moment of this year. It's taken up a lot of energy and emotion, rightly so, and interest. But the Black Lives Matter movement was an incredible source of thinking and language, and people writing and saying things that should have been and should have been said many, many years ago, and lots of emotional outpouring. That just captured most of the world's imagination and attention in the way it absolutely should do. We had a fantastic chance to speak to several people who brought that up. Candice Brathwaite, who wrote a book about being a young black mother in the UK, which was a really no holds barred account of what she felt like being and her experience within the hospital system and the medical system. She's brutal, absolutely brutal. Yeah. And when you read something, you go, this is a country that I live in.
It's extraordinary.
It's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. And like many people, and I don't want to kind of take this, too far, but I just, I really, the whole thing has made me stop massively and completely reconsider where we were. And that was absolutely most astutely felt when we spoke to Ibi Zoboi and Dr. Yusuf Salam about their book Punching the Air. We had them on the podcast. If you don't know, Ibi Zoboi, fantastic young adult author already, and Dr. Yusuf Salam was one of the now exonerated five, one of the Central Park Five, and to be able to speak to him in person about this book and his experience was incredible. And, Tom, what was so fantastic about this book as well, it's a young adult book, and Edie, Edie Pops, my 17-year-old, she obviously has been absorbing a lot of this information on the news and around her and with her school friends and stuff. And she was watching the Netflix series When They See Us, which is based on the story of the Central Park Five. Yeah. And, again and again and again, she came in and sat with me and was just sort of so... rocked by the fact that things like this can happen in her lifetime. And she read the book and she basically took it to school. And I think they've organised to speak to Ibi at some point and whatever. Amazing. Because she was just so motivated by it. And this is a little bit where he talks about his advice for any young people wanting to change the world.
One of the biggest things I always remember is that someone used their privilege in the past to help me. And it's our job to use our privilege to help others. We don't necessarily have to be in America to be able to really reach out and uplift and add truth, speak truth to power. But I think anywhere we are, anytime we see an injustice, we have to speak out against it. I come from a faith that says that if you see a wrong, you should change it. And you can change it in one of three ways, whether you speak out against it or you change it with something physical, like you can stop somebody from doing something bad, or you can hate it at least within your heart. And I think that's the important part, because a lot of times when you think about what we're responding to, we are responding to the humanity in others. And sometimes we see others and they're completely over, like trampling over our human rights, trampling over our civil rights, completely oblivious to it all. But once we see people for people, see people for who they are and truly what they need to be, then we have this awesome opportunity to allow them to exist. And it's about coexisting. It's about, psychosocially, everyone matters. And as we begin to teach people and tell people that they are valuable, then they begin to add value. That's one of the reasons why in Punching the Air, we chose so many different examples, whether that was through the teacher, Miss Rinaldi, whether that was through the prison officer, whether that was through even the persons in the prison that befriended Amal. There's all of these opportunities of expression that you can see yourself in and figure out, well, this is a book of fiction, but we also know that it is based on my story. And we know that because it's based on my story, there is some truth that some people somewhere have gone through something like this. We have now the opportunity to choose better, to choose different. Especially as a teacher, we don't have to take a child that's in front of us and recreate them in our minds to make them into what we want them to be. We have the opportunity to say, hey, who is this child? What can we do to make this child, the best caretaker of tomorrow by doing what we have to do today?
I still, honestly, I feel like I had to go and have a little cry after I spoke to him. And I'm still feeling quite emotional about it again, because you know, to have the opportunity to speak to somebody who went through what they did. There's, a great mind, a young boy who went to jail for something that they didn't do for 13 years. Yeah. And we know that Trump was at the forefront of calling for the death penalty for them. And that happened in our lifetime. It's recent times. Yeah. And for him to kind of come forward with such a positive book.
Such clarity.
Such clarity.
Purpose,
yeah.
You know, all these. Yeah. All these things we have to listen to. And it's interesting you were saying about Edie, you know, your child reading this stuff. And people talk a lot about kids reading this and how we tell our kids and how we educate our kids. And that's obviously absolutely maximum importance. But the other thing that we need to do is get in touch. This sounds really mad, but get in touch with our inner child and educate ourselves and remember that we are all still learning about this stuff and watching the BLM stuff evolve this year and reading these books and hearing these voices. You know, you need to challenge yourself. You need to look at yourself, and you need to shut up and listen. Certainly if you are, like we both are, white people living with tremendous privilege. And this year has been a very big moment for that.
If that book doesn't end up on a curriculum somewhere at some point, I'll eat my hat.
Well, I can bake you a hat if you like. You see my baking. It's absolutely top drawer. Just let me know. Honeycomb hat? Yes, please.
Yes, please. So, here's to a 2021 that's filled with great literature, brilliant stories, lots of love, lots of education and good vibes all around. I've got a good feeling about next year, Tom.
I think so. As long as it's a little bit less pandemic-y, that would just be lovely. Nice, wouldn't it? Until then, Happy New Year. And as always,
yes,
happy reading.
Reading.